You're listening to Munch, a podcast and website where we pair meals with movies. I'm one of the four horsemen, Ben.
I'm the other of the four horsemen, Andre.
And I'm the last of the four horsemen, Leanna.
And this week, we're here talking about Now You See Me for Magic Month, Jazz Hands.
Still not present, Dave Franco.
Sparkles! Yeah, Dave Franco is the other fourth horseman, but he couldn't be here because he's not actually a fourth horseman.
Definitely not.
Well, it's okay to refer to three of the horsemen as the four horsemen.
Yes, we learned that from this film.
We'll get to the film later. But yes, I think we're covered.
So we're here kicking off Magic Month, which is our idea to bring you a bunch of magic films.
In the month of July, when nothing important happens.
And the meals that go with them.
Magic is about to go off, has already gone off in the sky for the 4th of July, which already happened.
A long time ago.
A long time ago, and not on Tuesday coming up. Boy, were those fireworks magical this year, guys.
Andre, you remember that conversation we had a little bit before this podcast where I was like, all right, this has not happened yet. Let's pretend this is farther in the month. We still haven't. And then just like blank that part out. But
right.
Like,
we had that conversation and that was after we talked about how great the fireworks were this year and how amazing they were.
And how great Spider-Man Homecoming
was. So basically our timeline is all screwed up, which actually fits with the movie very well.
Now You See Me.
It was all intentional. That's part of the show.
Yeah. Leanna did a thing
with
her
hands. Yeah. Yeah, like if emotions and like movements came across in podcast audio, that would have been wonderful.
It would have been very good.
Unfortunately.
It's okay.
You know what else doesn't come through podcast audio?
Food.
Delicious looking food at that.
I nailed it.
Yeah, you did.
I'm a bit of a mentalist.
I almost gave you like the notes for this. So we did a magic meal, kind of like playing off classical magic tricks and everything you know about them and leaning into those like sleight of hand, distraction, all those moments. And to start out this meal, we went with a deck of cards style appetizer where we made saltine crackers cut out as cards and paired them with some delicious pimento cheese.
A little bit of magic happened for me tonight. I was telling Ben this, and now I'll tell the rest of the world. I thought pimento cheese was a type of cheese before we looked up this recipe, and I realized it was a pepper that you mix with like four different kinds of cheese.
So, like, what did you think that pimento cheese? Like, what animal did you think it came from?
I'd never thought.
What did you think it tasted like?
What did you think it looked
like? I've had pimento cheese before.
I have so many questions.
Oh. I've had it before.
Oh, so you just thought that was like what the cheese tasted like?
I thought that was pimento cheese, what I had. That was pimento. You've got cheddar cheese,
because you
Parmesan
you
cheese, pimento cheese.
Baby, that's so bad.
I wouldn't say it's bad.
Like, how often do you run into pimento cheese?
That is like harsh.
Yeah.
I mean,
you could say it's cute.
Okay, baby, that's so cute.
Thanks. So I learned that. I also learned pimento cheese is mostly mayo.
It's a lot of mayo.
It's a lot of mayo.
It was also a lot of cheese.
A lot of cheese.
Specifically Miracle Whip, though. Not just mayo.
Half and half Miracle Whip mayo. Yeah.
Wait, so like the recipe actually called for like Miracle Whip, but also mayo.
Yes.
Interesting.
It said Miracle Whip added a little bit of tanginess to it, and the regular mayo cuts that down a bit. Whoa. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm not, well-versed in the world of mayonnaise, but great to learn it from this recipe.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'm not well-versed in the world of pimento cheese, but this is a good one.
You know what else? We are just killing it with these segues.
Yeah.
You know what else you're not well-versed in? Beef Wellington.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That was a trip.
I've never had it before. So.
Leanna, would you like to tell us a little bit more about the second course of this magic meal?
Walk us through all 17 steps. Ready?
This is a doozy.
You have 17 seconds. Go.
Well, first,
and set it up in the form of a magic trick.
Oh, God. There's a lot of pressure.
You've already lost 4 seconds.
Okay, so first, we take a big slab of beef.
Tenderloin.
And
Center cut. From Rangeau.
I'm pretty sure.
You've got 3 seconds left.
It was good. I ate it.
Nailed
know.
It.
Okay, so going past the 17 seconds, you took that beef, mm-hmm. you seared it,
uh-huh.
so it got like a nice like crispiness on its sides. Then you slathered it with porcini and cremini mushrooms, and that was mixed with a pâté. What kind of pâté did we get?
Chicken liver.
Chicken liver pâté? Yeah. Okay. You mix that with the mushrooms, and then you slather that all over that lightly seared beef tenderloin. You wrap it in prosciutto.
Mm.
You put it in the fridge. Mm. While it's in the fridge.
That's the tasty stuff.
I don't know. It's preparing me for this tasty step, which is that like deep red center that we
This is the lead up. We haven't gotten to the turn.
Okay. What's the turn?
We're not there yet. So while it's chilling, you put some puff pastry in the oven.
Okay.
And it forms this beautiful pillow of puffed bread.
Okay.
You take it out of the oven, everything's cooling, and you're like, oh, nothing exciting is going on right now.
Actually, I'm just going to drop that.
The distraction?
Yeah.
That is totally like the, you're supposed to focus on.
It's not clear what's going to happen next.
Because I'm like, listening to you talk about cooking puff pastry. I thought we were making beef Wellington.
Right? Like, we've already talked about the beef, but suddenly we've switched to puff pastry.
I'm having a hard time tracking.
And you're completely thrown off because the puff pastry has grown to an enormous height. And you're like, what am I going to do with all this puffy bread?
What are you going to do with all that puffy bread?
What you're going to do is you're going to take that slab of meat and put it on the puffy bread.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And then you're going to cut out the bread so that it is just the right shape to like seat the meat. Then you're going to wrap it all in puff pastry again. And then you're going to cook it just enough so that it's done. But still, like, medium rare on the inside.
Just enough being, like, 45 minutes.
And you know what? The big reveal is when you slice it open.
Would you call this the prestige?
I would.
Okay.
And on the inside, perfectly medium rare.
Perfectly done.
And it has a previously unmentioned layer of prosciutto as well.
I mentioned that. You just weren't listening because of my sleight of hand.
There was also a ton of steps.
Yes.
Like, that's the takeaway of this dish that I'm not sure if I'll ever make again. Despite it being very delicious.
It was a full afternoon.
Yes.
Is it just takes three people.
Yeah.
It takes a very long time. And this was actually the first time I have ever had beef Wellington.
Same.
Yeah,
Proper beef Wellington. So I'm glad we were able to do it in a munch environment and that it turned out, which is supposedly a notoriously difficult dish. We can call that our greatest magic bag.
Yeah. And also one of the reasons for picking it was that we felt that it resembled the classic trick of cutting a person in half.
Yeah. That box saw, it has a better name than that.
I don't know what it is.
I think it's called sawing someone in half.
Oh, that's a good name.
Yeah.
That's it.
The saw in half trick.
Yes.
And to follow that up, I like to imagine that magic has a lot of similarities to design and that there's a certain selection of things you can do to draw a person's attention to something. One of those things being changing color. So for the dessert on this, Leanna found a really good recipe for a granita that actually changes color as you pour citrus over it. So using butterfly pea flower tea, turning that into a granita and then pouring lemon on top of that, it changes from like a deep kind of bluish purple into more of a pink color.
And granita is similar to like a shave ice.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it like has a really nice like deep color to it that felt very appropriate for both this film and magic in general.
And with the lemon squeezed over the top that changed the color, it also created a nice kind of Arnold Palmer type taste to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good.
A little citrus with the sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it went from like a deep purple to a kind of pink where the citrus hit it. It was really cool to watch.
And then we really went through some trouble to make the cocktail tonight.
It took a little bit.
Because I apologize if you are hearing this here first. And can we all have like a quick moment of silence for the fact that they have stopped manufacturing 151 rum?
May it rest in peace.
Did they say they stopped manufacturing it or that it's not sold in the US anymore?
I mean, if you live in the U.S., that's basically the same thing.
Sure. You can't get it.
I can't get it.
The man at QFC basically just said, like, yeah, they're just not making it anymore. So I don't know if that's just not being distributed.
You heard it here first. QFC said they do not make 151 rum anymore.
Yes. The official Kroger PR.
And an integral part of the cocktail tonight. Would you guys like to talk about it?
Yeah. It was a flaming Dr. Pepper. So the way this is supposed to work, you've got amaretto. You top it with 151, which is highly flammable. Drop that into a beer after lighting the 151 on fire. Drink it, and it tastes a hell of a lot like a Dr. Pepper. We couldn't get 151 rum, so we tried lighting regular rum on fire, and it didn't catch. So we took some Wild Turkey 101 and lit that on fire instead. So we still got the flames going. It still tasted very much like Dr. Pepper, like
maybe
surprisingly
like 16 well. Out of 23 flavors?
Yeah, I think we hit like 14 to 18. Like 16, actually, yeah. That's about it, right in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, we hit 16 of the 23 flavors. And it was a drink I'm probably not going to order again, but fun to do once.
Yeah, it's a, and also let's put a warning on this that if you are uncomfortable around flame, probably don't try this in your home.
Oh,
like,
definitely
there were
not.
Multiple suggestions and warnings as we were looking up recipes that, hey, just let a bartender do this. This is not necessarily safe.
Keep a fire extinguisher next to you.
Yeah, this isn't our first flaming shot, but that is not to say we have a ton of experience, but we're learning, and we were also very careful through this entire process to make sure that we didn't do anything crazy.
Another warning also, it's extremely potent. You will drink this, and you will feel it.
It's stronger than Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, yeah, it went up to our heads very quickly. And to close that out with a little factoid, Bacardi 151 was sold in the United States from 1981 to 2006. 16, sorry.
I was going to say, I bought it after 2006.
Yeah.
So relatively short-lived, all things considered, but it is still sold in Canada.
We're going to... We should just get some when we go to Canada.
Is that illegal? For?
Yeah.
You never know, Ben. It would have been helpful tonight.
I don't want it. It's a fire
hazard.
Babe,
if we see it, we're going to get it.
Are you really?
It's also those Canada prices. Canada charges so much for alcohol.
Ah, but it's like 30%.
They do.
Not if we get it duty free.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway.
Conversations you'll need to have in the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
That closes out this meal, which was, as we mentioned before, magic inspired. I think we're all pretty happy with how it turned out.
Should we discuss, or at least mention, the drinking rules that will follow this entire month of magic?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, because how we set up this month was similar to kind of what we did for our Spider-Man posts. Was we chose one set of drinking rules that would span the entirety of all of our magic films. So we have a couple doozies in the line, all relating to magic itself. The drinking rules that are going to span all of those are drink whenever magic happens, which is like pretty straightforward and is a kind of big moment and impressive.
And honestly, if you are feeling intimidated by the other two rules, you could just do that rule and you would have a
very fun
night.
Well, for Now You See Me too, at least. Or Now You See Me. Because there's a lot of magic in that movie.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot of magic in all of the movies we're going to watch.
Yeah. Okay. So, second rule. Drink whenever you, the audience, are in disbelief. Which happened a couple times in this film.
Yeah.
Like, there were moments of like, holy wonder.
Yeah.
And there were moments
especially
where
like
we were,
the first half an hour.
Yeah, and we were looking at each other like, oh my god.
How did they pull
did
it
off?
Did
you catch that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very magical.
And finally, drink whenever someone is skeptical of magic. Something that seems to run through a lot of these films is just humans. Like, they often play with the idea that you as the audience understand that magic isn't real, or is it? And it plays on that conception of it throughout a lot of these films that we're going to watch. So drink whenever there's skepticism of the magic happening.
Which happened a little bit in this movie, but immediately they were proven wrong. Anyone who disbelieved.
Yeah. Which, like...
The Muggles got their comeuppance at the end.
Which there's some things to talk about, because I think the majority of the skepticism in this film came from the Mark Ruffalo... All right. Came from the Mark Ruffalo character.
Who was also the worst...
He wasn't anyone's favorite, but he might have been our least favorite character.
I'm pretty sure he was our least favorite character. Yeah. Like, there was a lot of debate over who was the best character, but there was never any debate that, like, Mark Ruffalo was actually the worst. Like,
Hated him as an actor until The Avengers, where I thought he was okay, and The Normal Heart, where I thought he was really good. But before that, I thought he was a bad actor.
And the kids movie, are... He's pretty good, and the kids are...
I don't know if I've seen that
We
should watch that for Munch at some point.
He deserved an Oscar for 13 going on 30 as well.
Did he now?
No.
Liana's original knowledge of Mark Ruffalo comes
from... No, but I think that really is the first time I saw him as an actor.
What
other than that, I think I am with Andre. That, like, I didn't really give him...
Was he the love interest in 13 going on 30?
Yes.
What is it about... Like, Mark Ruffalo isn't... what you would consider a traditionally handsome man.
He's okay.
Exactly. He's okay. But, like, what? I mean, Matthew McConaughey is, like, a couple levels.
We can't all be Matthew McConaughey.
You're not wrong.
I don't know. I don't get the allure, but... I'm with Andre in that I didn't really give him much thought, and then he was in The Normal Heart, and I thought he was incredible. And it's weird going back to a movie.
He was good in Spotlight, too.
He was very good in Spotlight.
He was in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Oh, I don't remember that at all.
I don't remember that either. Maybe it was like a brief...
It must have been a small part. Maybe he was like a brother-in-law or something. That sounds right.
I remember Zodiac was probably a big moment for him.
But in this movie, he was just obnoxious, angry, a constant disbeliever in magic until,
well... And pretty misogynistic, like, also.
Like, pretty darn rude as well. Like, no one would want to work with this dude.
No.
But that is all to say we are going to dive deep into the spoilers on this podcast, because the ultimate twist of this film...
And turn it off if you don't want it to be spoiled right now.
Or just listen to it, because this film's a couple of years old.
Also, Now You See Me 2, you can still watch that. And also, Now You See Me 3 is coming out. So, like, maybe you should just listen to this podcast as a way to, like, prep yourself next.
Yeah.
So Mark Ruffalo ends up being the master magician controlling everything from the behind the scenes. And he's ultimately been there the entire time. Playing for the audience itself and being...
It's a bit of a conflict of interest, because he's also the lead detective on the investigation.
Yeah. But so. I have to say, in this film, they show this hooded character early on, and the whole movie you're just like, who could it be? And you kind of think it's Morgan Freeman.
But you also forget about him a little bit.
Yeah, you totally forget
about him, but you still know that there's this, like, overarching, like... mastermind that the four horsemen are kind of like leading up to. And never once did it cross my mind that Mark Ruffalo was actually that guy, because I just hated him so much and he was so awful that I was like, no, like, this guy, I was pretty convinced that he was just playing the trope of the, like, annoying cop that just can't catch the villain. You know?
Yeah, like, one of the worst things about this film is that, like, ultimate turn, you don't feel good about it, because ultimately you hate Mark Ruffalo.
You hate Mark Ruffalo so much.
It doesn't, like, clarify things or cast things in a new light. Like, I still don't understand what that means.
Like, it just feels like...
Okay, hold on. Can just really quick.
Yeah.
Why is it a big deal that he's the leader? My understanding is he did all of this to take down Morgan Freeman. because
Thaddeus Bradley, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of an incident with a safe
yes.
that killed his dad.
Correct.
How was Morgan Freeman involved with that safe?
All right. So Thaddeus Bradley, before he got on TV and was all about pulling apart the magic tricks that are popular, was a magician himself. Okay. And at the kind of peak of his fame, he was in a fierce competition with Mark Ruffalo's dad, essentially, which was Lionel Shrike. And so they had kind of back and forth, magical fights, if you will, that ultimately had Thaddeus Bradley, Morgan Freeman's character, on top. So Lionel Shrike had to turn around and one-up him, okay. as is the magician fashion. Or actually, like, if I remember correctly, Thaddeus Bradley showed how to do all of Lionel Shrike's magic tricks, which essentially just completely pulls away the claws of any magician okay. And kind yeah. of pulls that facade away. So Lionel Shrike had to ultimately do something that was going to one-up him and make it impossible to figure out. So what Lionel Shrike ended up doing was he got himself in a safe, which was dropped into the river, and he was supposed to escape. What ultimately Got happened it. Was the safe just kind of crunched in on him. There was some brief conversation about it not being made well, and we can all assume that Lionel Shrike died. Unless there's some reveal in Now You See Me Too that he's still alive. And
he's definitely still alive.
But this is all to say that Mark Ruffalo's character, Dylan Rhodes, set up this entire thing, got into the FBI, all to take down Thaddeus Bradley in a weird way.
Yes.
Yeah.
As far as we know, at least in this film. All to set
him up, frame him for a...
A bank heist?
Yeah, with, like, with no evidence French, against him.
One
yeah.
rich French guy, also. Like, one, like, random French guy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that clears it up for me. I don't think we have to go, like, too into the nitty-gritty of the plot, but...
But suffice it to I say, understand. I think some of your, yeah. like, confusion is oftentimes this film does not set up what is happening that well. Like, there were moments like, all right, why should I care about this bank safe in this moment that they did not set up with the impact
oh, yeah.
that it should
I
have.
I still feel a little
like I was like, all right, why is now everyone focused on this
the bank safe? Yeah. And, I didn't really understand what was going on with that either.
And it's such a quick moment that you're like, all right, why are they here? Why are they sad now? Why was I supposed to care about that? And what even led me up to that moment to care about?
Yeah, but every once in a while they will, it'll feel like something's going on for no reason, and later there'll be a huge payoff for that scene.
Yeah, and like, that is true, which happened once.
Yeah.
Once, like...
There was one yeah. scene that tied back on, like, five scenes previously that felt like a big payoff. Like, it felt really good. There were a couple pointless scenes where you realize later that it was all... the magicians setting up for a major heist, and it's made really clear why they were doing it, and we were all in total shock, and like we were very impressed when it happened, which I was not expecting from this movie.
No, the level of satisfaction and entertainment that I felt in those 2 minutes
yeah,
almost huge. Made up for the fact that I had to watch a movie that was almost 2 hours long.
Like, that was one of the best twists I had seen recently, and it was done in like the first 20 minutes of the movie, which is kind of cool. Like,
let's kind of stay away from using the word twist, because I think it's important to use twist for the end of the film. But okay. like the actual
it's a reveal.
Magic trick, that
it's
reveal of that magic trick in Act yeah. 2 of the Four Horsemen magic show.
Yeah.
Taking place in New Orleans.
Act 3 just kind of fell apart. But I actually yeah, enjoyed like the first
one,
half of the movie.
Act 1 was intriguing but confusing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was two, a lot of questions there.
A lot of questions. Act 2 was entertaining and fun and satisfying.
Like
and in Act 3, it just fell apart. Like, yeah. it was like, it was a whole mess of decisions were made that were just like...
Yeah.
I think we talked a lot about Act 3, but it might be more fun to talk about Act 1 and 2, which I think was fun because your perception of what's going on in the movie, with the plot, with the scene, and with the characters, like what characters you like and what characters you don't like, is changing like on a minute by minute basis.
Yes. And speaking of characters, we should definitely address the subject of was Dave Franco in this movie?
Dave Franco, I think, was added in post.
Yeah.
I think they needed a Franco to really get this movie
to really drive home that we have an all-star cast.
That we have a Franco. Like, go see this movie. We do have a Franco. It's Dave, but like, we do have a Franco in this movie.
I so badly wanted one of the turns to be that like Dave was actually James, and like that James Franco would just like walk out. Like, how good would that have been?
And like James is actually like in a scene with another character in the movie, and not just like by himself on the screen.
And the film needed that like level of ridiculousness to really make me on board with everything that was happening. It towed the line for so long, but never dipped its toe into it.
Yeah,
and so like. It just needed that level of like, all right, we accept that this is crazy, similar to what the Fast and Furious franchise has.
And the way they filmed Dave Franco, they had complete creative control over how they turned his character, because he was only in scenes, like scenes where you see his face with other characters' faces, three times in the whole film. And two of them took place on a set that looked... like exceedingly similar. Like they were supposed to be different places, but they looked so similar that like they could have fudged it, you know?
I kind of felt like very few of the actors were on set at the same time. Like it wasn't just Dave. Dave was definitely the worst offender, but there were very few scenes that would have more than like actor in it.
That's true, in that there were few close-ups, but there were lots of like sweeping shots of them on stages together where it was clear that
have your stand-in in those sweeping shots.
True, but it still felt like those characters had built more of a rapport, were working more together, and Dave was just kind of a lone wolf, and they brought him in, they paid him like a couple $100,000 so they could have a Franco in the film, and then they let him loose.
Dave was definitely the odd man out.
Yeah, it was obvious.
He was very much the fourth horseman.
Yeah.
There was even a scene where they continued to call themselves the four horsemen, and Dave Franco had supposedly died.
Yeah. And you're like, the other people are sad about it.
Yeah. There were three people on stage, and they were like, we're all here, the four horsemen. And like, Dave very much was not.
Dave was burning in a car.
Maybe they thought that he was going to be like green screened on because they had never seen him on set in the first place. And they were just assumed.
I mean, honestly, it's probably for the best that they weren't sad about that, because they were in on the trick the entire time and knew that he was alive and knew that they were going to see him.
But still, like, from an acting perspective, it would have made... like, they had spent the last 2 days building this persona as, like, the four horsemen, including Dave Franco. Yeah. And then they show up on their third and final trick, and they're like, we're all here, and Dave's just not present. And they're like, well, we're not going to mention it. Like, I think if you were like a diehard fan, like, if you were, like, what would you call, like, a super fan of the four horsemen? Like, a horsehead? Yeah, if you were a horsehead, you'd be like, where's Dave? Like, where's Dave?
He's my favorite.
Yeah, Dave's the best. Like, Dave has a sleight of hand. Like, he's the best of his kind.
Yeah, you just hear yells, where's Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I came here for Dave.
Who do you go to the show for? Like...
like, definitely Isla Fisher. Like
Isla Fisher. Yeah. Okay.
It Henley? Was that her name?
Henley is her name, yeah.
Yeah, Henley.
What was it about her that you really liked?
I really liked that she would just take control of the stage. Like, every once in a while, she would just take her moment and step in front of all the other dudes and just be like, and now, and, like, just take, like, she owned the stage whenever she was speaking. Okay. Like, I really respected her stage presence.
Okay.
Yeah. Also.
At the same time, I never, like, for me, I never felt like she believed that she was acting as a magician on a stage like that. Like, she felt very
ham-fisted
in her approach. coach.
I think her background as an assistant definitely, like, fueled her imposter syndrome. Okay. And so it held her back a little bit. And I think that's what you were sensing.
Yeah.
But
I almost wish they had dived into that a little bit more.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. But she also...
So wasn't exactly a character-driven movie.
That is for sure.
It's no Mad Men. Ben, what about you?
Or Leanna, were you going to say something else or no?
I think I've forgotten at this point, but Henley was my favorite.
I could see that. Thinking about all the characters, I mean, Jesse Eisenberg's character kind of just never had, like, a great moment personally for me. Like, he was there, you knew his character within the first 5 minutes of the film. And
smart aleck.
Yeah, and he never showed anything more or anything less than that. So I would have to probably go with Woody Harrelson's character, Merritt McKinney, because he seemed to be having the most fun on screen.
Oh, God, yes.
He was hamming it up just enough for the camera, and he embodied that character pretty well, and I could believe him as being kind of a somewhat skeevy mentalist, and while still playing that Robin Hood character. And there was just some scenes where, like, he would get this shit-eating grin across his face, and it was just like, yeah, you're just having a good time with this.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement there. Woody Harrelson was by far my favorite. His outfits, all of his fedoras were just a whole lot of fun to watch as well. His acting, his I think he accepted,
the most comfortable.
Like, you know, I just did True Detective. Now I want a paycheck. And this is fun. This is easy. And I only have to come on set for an hour a day. And I'm just going to have fun while I'm here. Like, that's kind of the vibe I was getting from Woody movie. And I liked it.
Yeah, I could totally see that. You know, I'm going to bring this back. Similar to what happened in Act 2 of the Four Horsemen magic show. Mm-hmm. And that was, they brought all the things that they set up with about 20 minutes ago, and then finally decided to talk about it and bring it all back. Similar to what we're doing here, in which we set up what was going to happen in Act 2, but never actually talked about it.
Oh God, where is this going? I'm so lost.
We're not going anywhere. It's just, we're going to actually talk about Act 2, which Andre started to talk about, but then we broke into characters, and I was like, oh my gosh, we just lost that thread completely.
No, we didn't. We're coming back right now.
Yeah,
okay,
because it's still worth talking about.
Okay. What? Like, explaining what happened?
Yeah, the actual moments and why it was impactful and why it was interesting. And that, like, and why Act 2 was most important to us. Because the Act 2 magic show starts out as, like, somewhat kind of generic. Like, all right, we are going to do a rabbit, disappearing rabbit trick. Here it is, here it's gone, and then they describe it. And then there's a few moments where it's like, all right, I am going to hypnotize all of you, put you to sleep, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do, and then you don't see that for another 20 minutes.
Well, I think it needs a little bit more detail. They say, when you hear the word freeze, you're going to tackle whoever says freeze. Like, you're all linebackers on a football team. You're just going to, if you hear someone yell freeze, you will activate and you will tackle. You'll tear them apart.
Tear them limb from limb?
Yeah.
Is that
he said tear them limb from limb, which,
jeez,
thankfully.
Pretty brutal, yeah.
So that was like one.
Uh-huh.
The second one was...
Well, one was the money.
Yeah. So they start setting up this larger trick where audience members stand up and they talk about the amount they have in their bank accounts. And this is all taking place in New Orleans on Mardi Gras weekend, of all things. And
which was a weird choice. Like,
yeah.
I guess for these audience members, they were like, well, the magic show is just supposed to be 10 minutes long. And I've got 10 minutes to spare, so... Sure. I'm like, between one bar and another, I'll go to this 10-minute long magic show. Yeah. Why not?
And so a bunch of people stand up and they say they don't have a lot of money in their account. And then everyone takes out a flashlight and runs it over a imaginary check with the amount they have in their bank accounts. And all of a sudden, somewhere between like $70,000 and $100,000 appear. And it's all coming out of this investment banker's account that who kind of made his money off of what had happened during Hurricane Katrina.
But he also is, he owns like an insurance company that refused to pay for
what happened, essentially. Mm-hmm.
No, but what happened to the magician who's died in the safe.
Yeah,
as right? well, sure.
But we find that out later.
Yeah,
but
that's not really important for the scene.
Okay, but I'm just, you know, I'm just, it was a hard movie to follow, and I just, you know, want the listeners to know that, like,
there were a lot of threads that didn't all come together as neatly as I think the film wanted.
Yeah.
But so it's almost more rewarding when you do figure it out, because you're like, okay, film, like, you made this really hard, but I got it.
Yeah.
I did it.
So ultimately, you see money coming out of this guy's bank with, like, a huge flashlight. And then during this, Mark Ruffalo's character, who you know at the end is actually the good guy through this all, runs up on stage to catch the four horsemen, yells freeze, at which point
the audience activates and takes him down. And they get away.
We were all shocked. Like, we all missed that.
Yeah.
It was an impressive moment of, like, having something happen a lot earlier and then finally bringing it back after you, the audience, had forgotten about it a little bit.
Well, you find out also that the way they were able to steal this insurance agency owner's money was this dumb scene earlier where Jesse Eisenberg was trying to show how easy it is to be a mentalist. And was asking him these, like, dumb questions, like, oh, I feel like your first dog's name was, Missy. And he's like, no, you idiot. Her name was, Rocket.
And she was later, a cat.
And she was a cat. And then that turns out to be the security question for his bank. And, they knew that. And that's why he set up that question. And he was able to rob this guy because he did that 20
which
minutes earlier in the
you
movie.
Might say is ridiculous, but also people are very lax on their cybersecurity, so like it's actually kind of believable.
Yeah, like in security trainings I've had, they're often like, all right, the biggest possibility of a breach is oftentimes your own personal information that you tell other people. I think it's called like
phishing.
It's not it's not just phishing, it's like social engineering. And it's just someone talking to you and pulling out information from you based off of you as a human being weak to social interaction.
The second biggest threat is just making your password.
Or 1, 2, 3.
Or
password 1, 2, 3, 4.
Or according to Prey, the game I'm playing right now, is writing your password on a sticky tab. It's really funny because you're playing the game and there's this PA system and it's like, remember, writing your password on a sticky tab, no matter how well hidden, is not good security. But throughout the game, like, you give people's passwords to their computers by finding the sticky tabs that they wrote.
I love that far into the future, like, that's still a thing. I know. Like, sticky notes are still a thing.
Humans will never learn.
It's so funny when you just go up to someone's monitor and there's a password and you can't get into the monitor, and then on the monitor there's a sticky tab that has a password, and it's just, I just love it every time it happens.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's good fun.
And all that's to say is, like, we were really impressed about how they brought something earlier that seemed to go nowhere. Mm-hmm. And like, we even commented, like, all right, what was that entire scene about? And they actually come back and make it meaningful and make it actually happen.
Yes.
And we want to applaud them for that, because that was one of the best moments of this film.
Very, it was a very like Ocean's 11 kind of moment. Or what's the movie I'm thinking of where you find out the heist already happened?
Ocean's 12.
Right. Yes. Yeah. another Ocean's film.
Which I honestly didn't love that reveal either. Which
I liked it.
For me at least, it had a similar issue with this film. Is like, nothing set you up for me to feel satisfied by that reveal. It just happened. And to tell me it just happened doesn't make me feel impressed by their ability. Mm. It just makes me feel like you didn't provide me enough information for me to be impressed that they were able
to. But in this, we saw that, well, in the Act Two one, at least, we saw them.
Yeah, I'm talking.
Yeah,
I'm
and talking that, that's about what the I big like. Twist. Like, I enjoy the twist in the films where the breadcrumbs are all laid out for you, but you aren't in tune enough to put them together.
Yeah.
So that when they are like, actually, we already did this.
And you
and then
why?
They go back and they're like, here's what you missed. Uh-huh. You're like, oh, I did see all those things. I just like didn't connect the dots.
Yeah.
Like that's actually way more satisfying than just being like, oh, we just did it all in this like other scene that you like missed out on. And there's all these assumptions like, yeah, we can totally fit in a box to fit below a safe. And yeah, we can totally hypnotize a guy on a stairwell. And yeah, we can totally make a mirror box that people would not.
I have kind of a personal theory behind this, like things that are going on in a movie that they're, like you mentioned, they give you the hints and you just haven't figured it out yet. They do that in TV shows too, like Game of Thrones, and everyone like figures it out. Like my theory, my thinking behind this is, in a movie you're like there, you're sitting down, you're watching the movie the whole time, you don't have any time to like do your own thinking about what's going on while you're watching the movie. You think about it afterwards. So with these TV shows, they also like to leave the breadcrumbs and have the big reveal, but you have time in between each episode to like think about what just happened, what might happen next. And so you can kind of make those predictions. But in a movie, like you don't have that time to put the pieces together.
Yeah. You can't like crowdsource to the audience. You have to like, you're just sitting there watching.
Yeah.
So they fundamentally just have to do it in a very different way.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They have to do more flashbacks.
And, but still, yeah. like...
Or just, like, seeding that story with, like, moments that you may not necessarily cue in on, but are actually there and ultimately reveal something. Like, not to, like, spoil another piece of media, but in Persona 5, there's a moment where... kind of one of the guys that ultimately becomes
I'm still playing this game. I'm not done with it yet.
All right.
Okay, what about the Italian job? Because they totally do this in the Italian job.
What about the Italian job, Leanna?
I haven't seen the Italian job in a little bit, so I can't follow you on this track.
So here's the thing. Like, I don't remember specifically what it was. I just know that this happens in the Italian job.
Where, okay.
That's always
like,
a great start.
The end of the movie happens and everyone's hugging and you're like, oh, I get it.
What do you get?
the twist.
What's describe the twist and why that makes
sense. I do love that part of the Italian job where they all hug and you're like, yep, the twist.
It's a good twist.
That was a good twist.
It's like a...
That's my favorite.
It's kind of like an orange vanilla twist, like a creamsicle twist.
Oh, man.
Well, that's like, good
twist. It's
okay,
so good. And
see.
It makes the hug so much stronger.
Those are solid hugs.
After having been through that, and then to find out it was actually that?
Yeah, like, have you ever had, like... I can honestly say I've never had, like, a solid twist hug.
Yeah.
So like I don't know what that hug feels like.
Yeah.
But I bet it feels dang good.
If it feels as good as it looks in the Italian job.
Ooh, then... peanut butter chocolate twist.
Oh,
that's
man.
A good twist right there.
Yeah, that's a tasty hug.
So, okay, in the Italian job.
Maybe like a cinnamon roll twist? Can we count that as a twist?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit different
twist,
of a twist.
Twizzlers? I mean, that's a little too samey.
Twistler.
Twistler.
I think they eventually came out with Twizzlers that had, like, two different colors in them. So, like, those are basically, like, a Twizzler twist. I think we can include that in the scenario.
And they're also hugging, which is cute.
Yeah, that's a good moment. They're basically just one long hug continuously.
Isn't a hug just two people twisting together?
I like to think of it like that.
I think that was the twist of the Italian job.
Yeah, like, should we just not refer to it as hugs anymore? Just like, I twisted you the other day.
Yeah. That was a really great twist.
That was a solid twist.
Is that what you were talking about?
Job.
Is that what you were talking about in the Italian
job? No, in the Italian job, they're all driving Mini Coopers. And
that was a good twist.
And then there's a twist. And then they hug it out. It's like just really solid twist.
No, there's like... There's a thing that goes wrong with a bomb where, like, a truck drops through the street. Uh-huh. And at this point, you're like, it's all gone wrong. They can't possibly come back from this. Mm. And then in the moment where they're hugging,
yeah,
you find out how they came back from that. And you're like, I didn't think this was possible. With the Mini Coopers?
I'm having a hard time following.
So it's like a twist. Like, it was a twist during the twist that they were having going on between
them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Intuition.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So the Italian Job has a good twist.
Okay. Preparing us.
You heard it here first. We
finally watched the Italian Job.
You heard it here first.
Please don't make me watch it alone. I already have a long enough list.
I'm interested in watching. Like, that's not a sequel anyways.
Yeah, that's true.
Unless there's an Italian Job.
They could totally make an Italian Job too. Like, no, they never made one.
You sure?
The first one has Charlize Theron, Edward Norton. Yes.
I haven't seen it in a bit, so I've forgotten completely. Matt Damon. I just remember there's Mini Coopers in the film.
Everyone remembers that.
Matt Damon?
Do you remember the twist? I think
Charlize Theron is more memorable.
Mark Wahlberg, Edward Norton, Jason Statham.
Jason Statham's in it?
Yeah.
Well, like, Mark Wahlberg and Matt Damon are practically interchangeable.
Not really. I like Matt Damon a lot.
Mos Def / Yasin Bey's in it. I don't remember it. The couple people you mentioned are not in this film.
You mean Matt Damon?
Yeah, Matt Damon's definitely not in this film.
But Charlize Theron is.
Charlize Theron is. Yeah,
and so is Edward Norton.
Yep, and Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, that's the twist.
Yeah, it's Mark Wahlberg the whole time. Not Matt
you
Damon.
You think it's Matt Damon.
Like, it says starring Matt Damon at the beginning, but in the end credits, you, like, shine a flashlight over Matt Damon.
And it turns into Mark Wahlberg. Yeah, there we go.
Wait, was Michael Caine in that?
Yeah,
Michael
he was.
Caine. Okay. Because I was going to say, here's an article. Michael Caine reveals all about the planned Italian Job sequel and his experience with marijuana on the Jonathan Ross Show. It's I laughed for 5 hours. I nearly got a hernia. That was a really bad long Michael title. Caine.
Yeah, that was not good.
Yeah, Michael Caine was
although we did all get super excited when we saw Michael Caine in this movie.
Yeah.
You know what else we all got excited for?
Who?
Common.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Common.
There's not enough Common.
Not enough Common.
He was in, like, three scenes. Lines.
Not enough lines. One other thing I want to talk about on this film is one thing I couldn't help but notice at every single moment during this film is just how much better this film could have been. Like, it has such a good core, mm-hmm. and you can see the inspiration points for this film, like, hey, people love bank heists and a good Robin Hood story, and you
also
know what?
Magic.
Like, magic still has, like, an enduring appeal after all mm-hmm. these years. What if we put all those into a film and it's going to do bangers, right? Like, let's get some big name actors and we're all going to be happy.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it falls flat in more than a myriad of ways. Which we could totally list here, but I don't find that interesting. What I do find interesting, if Now You See Me was recreated in the model of Fast and Furious, what would this film look like?
Well, today? First of all, mm-hmm. the three acts take place all in the U.S.
Okay.
Incorrect move. Yeah. Definitely an international film.
Yeah.
Like.
Oh, so you're going like late Fast and Furious, not early Fast and Furious.
Yeah, like, okay. They don't all take place in Las Vegas at different hotels. Like, that would not be interesting. Mm. They start in Las Vegas. I think that's still right. Yeah. Las Vegas is their LA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they have, like, a 1327 in Las Vegas.
Yes.
It's just in the Bellagio.
Exactly.
It's a single suite room.
Well, actually, it's the MGM.
Good point.
Yeah, it's so for MGM. Sure the MGM. But they start in Las Vegas, and then they go to, like...
Dubai.
No, they go to the... Where's
Dubai's for, like, Now You See Me 3.
Okay.
Yeah, no, they go to the city that they go to in Casino Royale.
Oh, the Monaco. In Monaco, I don't know. Is it just Casino Royale?
They go to Casino Royale.
Okay. Sure.
That's the second city that they go to.
That's a good one. Like, that like, ramps up the stakes. You know there's a lot of money there because, hey, people are rich in Monaco.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on board so far.
And then in the third one, I want to say they go to, like, Hong Kong or something.
I could see that. Somewhere a little more exotic, like a little...
Yeah, but also, like, you can get that idea of having it be a little more amongst the people. They go to Bangkok.
They're in like the red light district. Like it gets like,
yeah, like it's a little more amongst the people. It's like a tonal shift from Monaco. You then like where you have those stage lights and the uptightness of Monaco, you then completely break that apart for Bangkok and being amongst the citizens there. And they're already known across the world at this point as being expert magicians. And they do one final one to bring kind of money and freedom to
the masses.
Also, I imagine that Common plays a much larger role. He probably owns a casino. He's a very talented magician. World-class hacker.
He's definitely a hacker, yes.
Definitely rides with the crew. Great funny lines. Has, like, banter with someone else often. He's basically Tej.
Yeah. You can... Also, I think you can completely get rid of that Mark Ruffalo storyline. Like, cut that out. That's not ultimately interesting. The Robin Hood storyline's interesting. And then just have one core villain that you can keep, like, going up against. And understand that, like, it's ultimately to take this guy down.
Instead of the reveal being Mark Ruffalo, we were all in agreement that it should totally... maybe I'm speaking out of turn here. I don't know if we were all in agreement about this. But, like, I was in agreement that the big reveal, the person who should have been behind the whole thing... would totally be Daniel Radcliffe. Because he's in the second movie, and we all knew that. But, like, how good would that be for, like, the master magician to be Daniel Radcliffe, who's also Harry Potter?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I could see that.
That feels like the type of on-the-nose thing that Fast and Furious would also do.
Yeah.
Follow-up question. Is it still... all right, this is two parts. Is it still Four Horsemen? And who do you live in? Who do you take out?
Well, I like the name Four Horsemen.
Yeah, I see.
So that. I think it's four.
Okay.
Because that's, it has like, I don't know. You can't say
there's history.
Yeah, there's history there. For sure, you have to have Isla Fisher. You have to have Woody Harrelson. Like, he's a mentalist. Like, he brings a different skill. I could go with or without Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
Same.
Same with Dave.
Yeah, let's get James in there.
He was barely there. Like, if Dave...
if Dave... Franco might be the better Franco.
If Dave and James, had tag teamed it and that had been part of the reveal, I would say absolutely keep them in. But because they just had Dave, like, he wasn't enough.
I could see, like, Chris Rock, I think, would be a great horseman.
He's a little older, though, only thing. Like, not that I'm like against, not that I'm against older actors in films, but something about early day Fast and Furious was like, here's a scrappy bunch of people that are just coming together for the first time, and what you lose in the later Fast and Furious. But there's something there that I really like. And so, like, maybe, all right, hear me out here. But what if they don't go to Bangkok? What if they actually go to Korea? They're in Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Han.
How'd you know?
I just knew.
This film...
You get a tone in your voice
it's gotta be Han. He's older too, though.
But he has a...
He's ageless, actually, Andre.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't age.
He also has a sense of character. Like, I could go and, like, completely give my spiel about... Han, but like he has that like ease that none of the characters have, and it allows other actors to play off of him really well.
I mean,
so they
need
someone like that.
Giselle would have been way better in this too.
Would you replace Isla Fisher with Giselle?
If I could only have one woman in the Four Horsemen, yes.
I mean,
if I could have two, I would replace Jesse Eisenberg with Giselle.
I could also see Lucy Liu.
Let's just do, like, what if it was, like, all women? What if he had, like, all women as the Four Horsemen?
Ooh, now we're talking.
Definitely Gal Gadot, like, for sure.
I could see
She'd be in it.
Lucy Liu,
I'm in.
You need someone, like, you gotta have a comedic relief character. Like, who do we want, for that?
I cannot say her last name, but Lena Waithe.
Oh, like, I know who you're talking about. Yes.
In Master of None. She's
a, oh, yeah.
She's the main character in the Thanksgiving episode.
Deb's best friend.
Yeah.
Like, she'd be so good.
Yeah, yes.
She would be
fun. Like, I imagine her as...
She'd bring a completely different energy to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I, like... Lucy Liu's a little bit more of the uptight one, but, like, has the humor aspect. And then Lena comes in, and she's the one that, like... I could see her character going one of two ways. Like, she is the one that comes from kind of, like, a small suburban neighborhood and is kind of, like, surprised at everything that's going on, but is ultimately, like, the most knowledgeable about everything that's going on.
Completely.
And, like, kind of starts the final act happening.
And Giselle is just pure precision and technical knowledge and just makes everything come together.
Who is our date? Who dies? Who's barely in the movie and maybe comes from a bit more of a rough and tumble background? Maybe a little more...
All right. You two still haven't seen Return of Xander Cage, have you?
No. Oh, are you thinking Ruby Rose?
I could totally...
Ruby Rose.
Yeah.
It's either...
She would be a great magician.
She would.
Yeah.
It's either Ruby Rose or Deepika Padukone, who was in Return of Xander Cage.
But I'm really into the idea of Ruby Rose.
Yeah, I'm also into the idea of Ruby Rose.
So we've got Ruby Rose, Gal Gadot, Lucy Liu, and Lena Waithe. Sorry, Lena.
Yeah.
I apologize. But, like, those should be the Four Horsemen. That would be so that'd be fun. Cool. And apparently in the second movie, they just fucking replace people for no reason, it seems. Yeah. Because Isla Fisher is not in it. And we love Lizzie Kaplan, but it doesn't make any sense why she's there.
Yeah, so, like, they just couldn't get her or something.
So hopefully Now You See Me 3 is the four people that we just cast, because that would be legit.
Yeah.
You guys have anything else?
I think that's all I have to say about this movie.
I think that's
Lena D. Waithe.
Waithe.
Was that Siri?
Lena D. Waithe.
Thanks, Siri.
Lena D. Waithe.
Oh.
Lena D. Waithe. Lena D. Waithe.
Oh, that's a different one.
No.
Lena D. Waithe.
Oh, these aren't helping.
Lena D. Waithe.
These are all different.
Lena D. Waithe. Oh,
that one definitely did not help.
Yeah, no.
No.
Lena D. Waithe.
Lena D. Waithe.
Lena D. Waithe.
One of those.
So to close
average
this all,
those out.
Let's close out with kind of just some final thoughts. We had a lot to talk about, and so I want to hear one final thing from each of you about this film that you didn't get to air during the course of this podcast, but you just want to put on the table.
I mean, I love a good magic trick. So, this movie was fun to watch, even at times when it was boring, problematic, or just, like, confusing.
Noted.
So, I've completely signed on to watching the sequel, adding it to the list of sequels that I've committed to on this podcast. I want to know. Like, I want to see what's next. Like, the tricks are fun.
They're making a third.
They're making a third.
For me, it was, I just felt like... every scene Jesse Eisenberg was in, he just said to the director, could I do more of I just blanked on the name.
Mark Zuckerberg?
No. Geez, I had his name in my head and then I started talking and I lost it. Ben, you do yours.
Podcast
name. I know.
I think the one last
Aaron thing. Sorkin. Could I do more of an Aaron Sorkin kind of take here? Mm. Like,
quick, witty,
I really want to
dialogue.
I want to do some Aaron Sorkin dialogue here. Like, every single line had to be very fast, very witty, doesn't give you time to, like, he's, like, already talking before the last person's done talking, very quick.
I feel like every role of his is kind of the same at this point.
Yeah. Anyway, that was my thought on the movie.
My final thought is I am over romances and films that have no bearing to be in there.
Thank you for bringing this up. I totally forgot about this.
Should never have been, like, brought up at all. And that is all to say there's a final line in this film. One of the final lines in this film that is like basically Mark Ruffalo saying, I had everything planned out, but I didn't expect to meet you. And this is after Mark Ruffalo being a complete douche and extremely rude to Melanie Laurent. Yeah, and they somehow, through all that, find in love with no connection throughout the entirety of it.
There's literally a line where he says, I wasn't talking to you, I was talking to him. And, like, refers to, like, another guy who has some idea about where the Four Horsemen are. Like, it's so hard to watch. It is so, like, the animosity that he, like, continues to push towards her. And then all of a sudden we're supposed to believe that they have this connection.
Yeah.
Like, there were multiple points where we were even either, like, screaming no in when you could tell a kiss was going to happen, or just utter groans at the end when Mark Ruffalo says that line about Melanie.
So bad. It came out of nowhere.
Thank you for bringing that up. I forgot about it because it was so unbelievable. That was the most unbelievable part of the whole movie. Like, forget the magic. That romance was completely founded in...
They weren't building up to it at all. She just kissed him at the end, and you're like, where did that come from? Like, you knew it was going to happen, because you could kind of, like, can tell us that kind of movie.
And Woody Harrelson also hinted at it, and he is the Mentalist, so...
That's true. Good point. Good callback.
They probably added that scene in post, because they realized... through, like, audience testing, that their romance was so unbelievable that they had to have something to help, you know, prove that it was possible. And so they were like, Woody, can you just kind of ad-lib here and talk about the connection you see?
Use your actual talent that no one else here has.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, here's the actual line. And from that moment on, I created a persona. I planned. I worked out every detail. But the one thing I couldn't imagine happening was you.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to say, I know that the logical conclusion for you is to take this case to its resolution and for you to turn me in. Yeah, but you know what?
It was not great.
And that is all to say that this has been another episode of Munch. You can find our content in a variety of places. Our kind of main location is getmunchedup.com, where we are going to post photos of the food we cooked for this meal, as well as our reviews. You can find us on Twitter at getmunchedup. Instagram is getmunchedup. Facebook is also getmunchedup. Please send us an email at getmunchedup@gmail.com, or send us a... Or like, comment, and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. It helps us out a lot. And one final promo is from Jessica. She has started a new Instagram account. And if we want to hear from Jessica herself about said Instagram account, what would Jessica say?
Rosé all day.
And where can you find Rosé all day, Jessica?
A rose by any other name is Jessica on Instagram.
So check out that Instagram account. It's a wonder and a joy and all sorts of rosé basicness or extravagance or extraness. And that has been another episode. Good day.